know, people say, oh, I can wait another couple of weeks. And then they're like, oh my gosh, I need to make this happen.
Alaskans rush to sign up for health insurance before the open enrollment period closes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 18th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, unstable ice makes for a slow winter crab season in the Bering Sea.
You always take your chance when you put your pot through that it might not be there when you get back because of the ice breaking off with the winds.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A debate on a gas line megaproject is currently underway. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports from the Capitol.
The Senate is taking a vote on legislation authorizing the state to partner with the North Slope producers, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and TransCanada in construction of a natural gas pipeline that would cost at least $45 billion. The gas transported on the pipeline would be sold on the global market, and a portion would be reserved for Alaska consumers along the pipeline corridor. The Senate opened debate on the bill just before noon, and they heard amendments for over 4 hours. Of the 17 amendments introduced, just one was adopted, a tweak expanding access to a supplemental energy fund for just rural users off the road system to all Alaskans who live in places where energy isn't affordable. That amendment was introduced by Senator Mike Dunleavy, a MATSU Republican. The rest of the amendments were introduced by the Democratic minority. They argued for upping the state's equity in the project from 25% to 51% in order to make Alaska a majority owner. They proposed releasing the state from a deal with TransCanada, or at least altering the terms. They also wanted a guarantee that municipalities along the pipeline route would not lose the ability to collect property taxes on land used. Democrats hit on two themes with their speeches. One, that the bill was not being properly vetted. And two, that the legislature was being asked to rubber stamp a deal already agreed to by the Parnell administration and the oil companies. Here's Senator Bill Willikowski of Anchorage.
What I heard was that we can't support this amendment because it's outside the terms of the HOA, the heads of agreement. That's exactly what's wrong with this whole agreement, Mr. President. We have given our sovereignty over to four huge multinational corporations.
A final vote on the bill is expected this evening. It will then be sent to the House. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A bill authorizing the state to build a billion-dollar bridge across Kinnick Arm is back for consideration. The legislation was shelved for a year after an audit found traffic estimates for the project were unreasonably optimistic. During a hearing before the Senate Finance Committee, the bill sponsor dismissed skepticism that the project would pencil out. Representative Mark Newman from Big Lake said he absolutely believed there would be enough traffic to serve a two-mile-long bridge connecting Point McKenzie to Anchorage, as long as a MATSU population boom continues.
If the Kinnick area, Point McKenzie area, was a city, it would be one of the fastest, one of the top 50 fastest growing cities in America.
The current version of the bill scraps the idea of using a public-private partnership to build the toll bridge. Instead, the project would be funded through a mix of federal grants, federal loans, and state revenue bonds. Those loans and bonds would then be paid off using toll revenue from the bridge. But rural legislators expressed doubt that the tolls would be enough to cover those costs. Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat, noted the state would be responsible for making up the difference if there isn't enough bridge traffic. He said if it were clear the bridge would pay for itself, there would be broad support for the project across the state.
I think that was the crux of the concern, that the state of Alaska would be on the hook, and it was always portrayed that this was going to be a toll bridge and that would adequately address the construction.
Senator Donnie Olson, a Democrat from Golovin, worries that the cost of the project and the risk that comes with it is too high, given that the state is looking at a period of serious budget shortfalls.
It's a public policy issue that I have a problem with, where we're dealing with the state revenues going down, and certainly we've got an excellent bond rating, but in 5 years when all our savings are spent and we've maxed up to the hilt with bonding and indebtedness that's out there, that's where I've got problems.
To keep the project moving, the legislature would have to appropriate $10 million for the bridge in the next fiscal year. The Senate Finance Committee will continue discussion of the bill tomorrow morning. The House passed the bill last session. Alaskans working to sign people up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act say they're seeing a big increase in enrollments this month. Groups like the United Way and Enroll Alaska made the announcement at a press conference today in Anchorage. The boost comes as the March 31st open enrollment deadline approaches. Anyone who doesn't have health insurance by that date will pay a penalty unless they qualify for an exemption. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
During all of February, Enroll Alaska signed up a little more than 200 people for health insurance. In just the first week of March, they enrolled nearly that same number. Chief Operating Officer Tyann Bowling is excited to see the pace picking up.
We couldn't be happier with how things have gone this month. It has been an incredible busy month for us, and we see that we're going to have our largest enrollment month yet.
Bowling says the six-month open enrollment period has not been easy. The healthcare.gov website was barely functional the first 2 months it was live. Bowling says groups like hers lost momentum in those months that they may never recover. But she says it's human nature to procrastinate, and Enroll Alaska has the resources to help anyone who still wants to sign up.
You know, people say, oh, I can wait another couple of weeks. And then they're like, oh, my gosh, I need to make this happen. So I think that, you know, some people were right there on October 1st and standing at our door at 7 a.m. And then there's people who are waiting until right now to get through the door. So however they get there, we just want them to get there and to get enrolled.
And not everyone signing up this month is procrastinating. Susan Johnson is the regional director of the Health and Human Services Department. She says some people are still finding out about the benefits of the law. Johnson met a woman in Spokane recently who donated a kidney to her brother 3 decades ago and assumed she would be permanently excluded from health insurance because of her pre-existing condition.
There's a mindset, if you've been locked out, kept out, the door closed to you for over 30 years because you gave life to a family member, it's hard to get your head around the fact that now suddenly that door is open. It's unbelievable. And that's the power of this law.
By the end of February, more than 6,500 Alaskans had signed up for health insurance on healthcare.gov. Johnson is pleased with those numbers. She says Alaska is not an easy place to do outreach work on a complicated new law.
Using an Olympic metaphor, you're doing a triple sow cow, you know, with a wind of 70 degrees, miles an hour, and the lights just went off, and yet you're still hoping to land that. So you have a huge degree of difficulty. We know that. No roads, often no electricity, you know, no easy communication, off the grid with the computer.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has been doing Affordable Care Act outreach events in rural areas of the state. Alaska Natives can file for an exemption from the individual mandate to buy insurance because they qualify for health care from the Indian Health Service. But ANTHC's Valerie Davidson says the organization is hoping some Alaska Natives will see the benefit of having insurance too and may qualify for a substantial subsidy to help pay for it. She wants everyone to feel welcome asking questions about the law.
Maybe English isn't your first language. It's okay. Come on over anyway. We have people available who will speak to you in any language that you're comfortable with. So come on. Daringan. We'll understand.
Open enrollment closes for most Americans on March 31st and will reopen again on November 1st. But Alaska Natives and American Indians can continue signing up for insurance on the exchange all year long. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, is it a party or a ski race? Maybe both.
I am the universe today. You'll notice my space pants and my sun cape.
Okay.
Handmade.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com.
A resolution in the legislature urges quick action by Governor Sean Parnell to ensure Alaska doesn't lose in state refining capacity. HCR 22 by Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole is aimed at keeping Flint Hills North Pole Refinery in operation under a new owner. Flint Hills plans to cease refining this summer in favor of selling cheaper imported fuels. During a hearing yesterday, Representative Wilson told the House Resources Committee the current economic situation could change.
Right now, you can pretty much import most of the different kinds of fuels more affordably than refining it here at the present time. But as we see, most of the time, that can change as time goes on. And so not just the state, but I think the legislature needs to determine how valuable it is to be able to keep our refiners in the interior as well as other places in the state.
Wilson says Alaska's self-sufficiency is at stake. Flint Hills buys its crude oil stock from the state of Alaska, and the relatively higher price of that royalty oil is one of the reasons cited by the company for its decision to cease refining. Wilson's resolution urges the Parnell administration to negotiate a new contract with a potential buyer and consider a discounted price. Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash warned the state could endanger its revenue stream from North Slope production if it sells oil at a cut rate.
Our lessees would say, well, gosh, if you think your oil's only worth that much, that's how much I want to pay my royalty on. And we would very quickly find ourselves seeing all of our royalty production potentially valued at that price.
Representative Scott Kawasaki of Fairbanks questioned negotiating a new royalty oil contract when no potential buyer of the North Pole refinery has been made public.
It's good to know who we're negotiating with, and I'm just questioning the theory that if you throw something out there that we're going to actually get a good deal.
HCR 22 was held in the House Resources Committee. Public testimony will be taken at a future hearing. Lawmakers are considering the possible purchase of a legislative office building in downtown Anchorage as an alternative to the current leasing arrangement that critics have questioned as extravagant. The Senate President and House Speaker requested 7 working days to discuss the idea raised during Monday evening's Legislative Council meeting with their members. The proposal calls for authorizing the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to purchase the office building for about $28.3 million. The Council's chair, Representative Mike Hawker, a Republican from Anchorage, said the arrangement could save about $2.4 million a year. Earlier in March, 1.2 million pounds of Tanner crab were caught in the Southeast's commercial fishery, the biggest haul in over a decade. But in the Bering Strait region, the winter season for Red King crab has been abysmal. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Justin Nofsker is the office manager at Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation's processing facility in Nome and says the poor harvest has a lot to do with sea ice.
Just the ice keeps going out, coming in, going out. So that's the biggest thing. A lot of pots are getting lost this year. You know, the loads aren't as good as what we typically see because a lot of people are staying closer to shore just for the safety of the shore fast ice.
With erratic temperatures this winter, sea ice for much of the region, from Nome all the way to Little Diomede, has been slow to form and quick to blow out. Jim Menard is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and says when ice conditions are uncertain, people are reluctant to set their crab pots.
One of the situations here is the ice hasn't been very stable. And then you always take your chance when you put your pot through that it might not be there when you get back because of the ice breaking off with the winds.
Last year, conditions were reversed. The ice came early, stayed late, and contributed to a banner Red King crab winter harvest in the Bering Sea, about 62,000 pounds. But that year was a major outlier. Usually the winter harvest is under 10,000 pounds of Red King, which, compared to the 400,000-pound summer harvest recorded in 2012, is minuscule. And according to Tyler Rhodes, NSCDC's chief operating officer, when it comes to the economics of crabs, the Bering Sea harvest isn't big enough to send waves across world markets.
The prices we get when we sell them are really determined by a more global market. And especially this year, we're even less than a drop in the bucket this year. But even on a good year, you know, our contribution to the overall world crab markets are pretty small.
Winter crabbing around the Bering Straits region isn't the economic boon that it is during the summer, but Rhodes says it's a significant resource for independent commercial crabbers who get an income from selling to NSCDC.
Our fisheries are pretty small in the overall scale, but pretty large and important to the residents here and our resident fishermen.
Crab is also a subsistence resource, so there's likely a secondary cost supplanting the meat with store-bought groceries or digging further back into the freezer. ADF&G tracks the subsistence harvest by collecting self-reported crab numbers from individuals, then applying the average poundage from the commercial harvest. That way, they can estimate the overall health of the fishery. In a regular year, the agency issues around 150 permits to subsistence users in the region. Menard says this year it's been about 50, and mostly just in the last few weeks. And permits alone aren't assurance of a decent haul. With sea ice hugging so close to the shore, pots can't be set at optimal depths on the mild slope of Norton Sound's seafloor, and shallow pots don't catch as many crabs. So while there's no hard data yet on the harvest, things don't look so great. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Plans are starting to gear up for timber sales on state and university-owned lands in the area of the Tongass National Forest. KFSK's Jovik Nicky reports from Petersburg.
One of the planned university timber sales is on the Wrangell Narrows, about 14 miles south of Petersburg. It covers over 360 acres of mostly hemlock and spruce forest. The second is on the southern end of the island. It's near Banana Point, about 29 miles south of town. That parcel has over 300 acres of old-growth spruce, hemlock, and yellow cedar. Patrick Kelly is regional resource manager with the university's statewide land management system office in Anchorage. He says helicopter logging is planned for both sites.
Now, the South Mitkoff parcel has existing Forest Service roads, and there may be some conventional logging activity on that. That's up to the bidders, but the intent was a collaborative effort with the U.S. Forest Service and the Alaska Division of Forestry. There's a helicopter in the area at this summer and a very limited time window for use of the helicopters.
Total estimated timber volume on the two parcels is 6 million board feet on the Wrangell Narrows site and 11.5 million at the South Mitkoff site. However, Kelly says the total volume harvested will be lower than that amount and will be up to the winning bidder for the trees.
What it does is it really narrows down the field of what they will cut and certainly reduces the impact.
Proceeds from the two timber sales will help fund university scholarship and research programs. Logs from the sales can be exported. The land office hopes to award the timber sale contracts in late April. Also this spring, a state agency is drafting a plan for the newly created Southeast Alaska State Forest. That's state land on 40 parcels covering around 48,000 acres. The legislature designated the lands for timber sales in 2010 and 2011. Jim Schwarber, forest planner with the state's Division of Forestry, says one of the requirements for establishing a new state forest is writing a management plan for the land.
And we're currently working internally to develop that draft and are also doing public involvement outreach with scoping and seeking input from the public and agencies and other entities as we put together the first draft plan for this new state forest.
Near Petersburg, some of the parcels are on eastern Mitkoff Island. Others are on the southern end of the island near the planned university timber parcel. Schwarber says the state is asking for input from people who have used the lands in the past or who know about the different areas of Southeast.
All state forests do provide for multiple uses, though it's important to recognize that the primary purpose for a state forest, in particular this state forest, is timber management and timber production.
The Division of Forestry hopes to release a draft plan for public review later this spring. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A heli-ski guide caught in an avalanche over the weekend near Haines died late Monday, according to a statement posted online by his family. Aaron Karatis was guiding a group of skiers with Haines Heli-Ski and Company Southeast Alaska Backcountry Adventures on Saturday. Fellow guides found Karatis within 15 minutes, thanks to a locator beacon he was wearing. He was unresponsive and CPR was started. He was transported to the Haines Clinic, then flown to Providence Medical Center in Anchorage. The statement from his family and medical team says Karatis's core body temperature was critically low when he arrived at Providence. He had inhaled snow, compromising oxygen flow to his brain. Karatis is originally from Bend, Oregon, and has been active in heli-skiing for more than a decade. The state's Division of Parks and Recreation has reorganized the management of structure of two of its largest parks. As part of the reshuffling, one of Wood-Tikchik's two park rangers will be assigned to Chugach later this year. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Both the Chugach State Park outside of Anchorage and the Wood-Tikchik State Park north of Dillingham will soon fall under one park superintendent. Chief of Field Operations for the Parks Division, Claire LeClaire, says this current change was one of several that have been made, primarily in the Chugach and Kenai Prince William Sound State Park units. The management goal is to provide better staffing at busier areas without having to hire anybody new. That's because budgets are tight in the Parks Division, as they are across many state agencies.
You know, we're just like the schools, basically. There's no inflation proofing on the state parks budget, but our costs increase every year. So we are trying to do our best to make sure that the resources we have are allocated in the right way in order to better address our workload.
Ranger Bill Burkon will stay as the permanent ranger based in Alectinggik. Ranger Allison Eskelin will move to Chugach. Eskelin is one of the Parks Division's few trained pilots, and the plane the park acquired last year will move with her. Claire says that although the permanent staff will be reduced by one, there will be some flexibility to assign augments from the other staff.
Once this reorganization's in place, what you'll basically have is six rangers working in this area, this southwest Chugach area, one of those rangers being assigned all the time to Wood-Tikchik, and the other rangers and other staff members of Chugach State Park will have work assignments in Wood-Tikchik.
The change in personnel and supervision is expected to happen at the end of this coming summer season. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Last weekend, hundreds of skiers descended on Talkeetna for the Usyk Classic Ski Race and Tour. Some come to compete and others wear costumes. Everyone comes to have a good time. KTNA's Philip Manning was there and has this report.
The Usyk is one of the largest classic ski races in the country. This year, just under 700 skiers came from all over Alaska to Talkeetna to participate. Just 2 weeks ago, however, there was serious concern on the part of the race organizers. Temperatures were high, and the snow on the ski trails was quickly taking on the consistency of concrete. With time ticking away before the event, Denali Nordic Ski Club member Chris Mannix had some friends over to make a sacrifice to the patron god of skiers.
We've done it once before, and it worked then, and so we did it again. We burned skis, and it snowed. So Uli smiled on us.
With fresh snow, the Usyk was looking to proceed smoothly. That is until temperatures reached the high 40s once again, just a day before the race. Willie Pretty is part of the trail grooming crew and says it took extra work in the pre-dawn hours before the race to make sure everything was ready for the noon start.
There were four of us that got up at 4. Actually, we got up about 3 a.m. this morning and all gathered at 4 a.m. and we set track between 4:30 and 9:30.
The somewhat backcountry nature of the trail is part of its draw. U.S. Olympic skier Holly Brooks came to ski in the Usyk and explains why the race is a favorite around the state.
People come out here, I mean, just right now, everyone's smiling, there's music, there's Christmas lights, there's good food, people are friendly, you know, it's always a good time to come out to Talkeetna. The course is a blast, you know, I'm hoping there's some narrow tree skiing, which is always fun. People dress up, you know, it's a good party after. I've had a really good time swing dancing late into the night here in the hangar before.
Holly Brooks is fresh off a tour of skiing that included the Olympics in Sochi last month. Before the race, she said she wasn't sure whether she would take a more relaxed pace or let her competitive spirit take over.
I'm going to kind of just go out there and see what I feel like. You know, I've been home for a day and a half. I've been gone on the road for 4.5 months and pretty tired from all the racing and jet setting that I've been doing.
Holly Brooks must have still had some fuel left in the tank, however, as she went on to win the women's 50-kilometer race. In addition to the super competitive skiers, many participants in the USIC don't bother with the race itself, but treat it as an opportunity to have fun on skis. For many, like Kelly Donnelly, that means donning a homemade costume and hitting the trail.
I am the universe today. You'll notice my space pants and my sun cape.
Okay.
Handmade.
Nice.
So I thought I'd go with the whole blue theme and be the entire universe.
Local skiers get involved as well. Galen Johnston, who grew up skiing the trails around Talkeetna, now coaches skiing at Diamond High School. He says this year's trail offered some variety.
Much more technical from a skiing perspective. Still mostly double pull. That's kind of the status quo for this race. But it was a lot more hills than the last couple years, which is, it was fun to mix things up a little bit. And, you know, some more gliding. It's not just all constant double pull.
Organizers say this year's USIC was a big success. Chris Mannix says the real measure of how well the race goes can be seen on the faces of the skiers as they reach the finish line.
It went fantastically. The weather, what do you say? I mean, last night at 8 o'clock it was raining, and then it turned around. We had a beautiful day, and the course held up, and it was just awesome. A couple of glitches out there, but, you know, I saw people skiing across the finish line with big smiles on their faces saying it was fun.
After the race, the party hosted by the Denali Nordic Ski Club lasted well into the night. On Sunday, hundreds of cars filtered up the Talkeetna Spur, but many will be back for next year's USIC Classic. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Jack Jovicnicki in Petersburg, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.